This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Welcome to What Makes It Great. I'm David Ozenberg. This is our third season of broadcasting this very popular series as hosted by composer, conductor, author, and commentator Rob Capello. For over 20 years, Rob has brought the joy and wonder of classical music and unraveling some of its mysteries to audiences of all ages and backgrounds. One of the greatest communicators since Leonard Bernstein, Rob's programs are characterized by his unique ability to create that aha moment for his audiences and collaborators, whatever their level of musical sophistication or naivete. Rob's work brings music into people's lives, opening new ears to musical experiences and helping people to listen actively rather than just hear. Rob's range of activities is astonishingly broad, including his What Makes It Great presentations, now going on for over 20 years in New York and Boston, his family compositions and family music events, his city pieces, corporate programs, and residencies with institutions as diverse as the National Gallery of Canada and Stanford University. The reach of his interactive events and activities is wide, from Native American tribal communities in Montana and inner-city high school students in Louisiana to audiences in Kyoto and Kuala Lumpur, and from little ones barely out of diapers to musicologists in Ivy League programs. His career has been marked by numerous major awards and grants. He won first prize in the Fontainebleau Casa des Sioux Piano Competition and was second prize winner of the Entel Dorati Conductors Competition with the Detroit Symphony. He's also been a recipient of an Exxon Meet the Composer grant and numerous ASCAP awards. He's conducted many of North America's orchestras, as well as new works of musical theater, ranging from the Tony Award-winning Nine on Broadway to the premiere of Frida for the opening of the Brooklyn Academy of Music's Next Wave Festival. At 19, Rob interrupted his academic work at Yale University to study with the legendary Nadia Boulanger. 2 years later, after graduating Phi Beta Kappa from Yale, he continued his studies at Eastman School of Music. After graduating from Eastman, he returned to Yale, where he was assistant professor for 6 years at the university. He dedicates his summer months to writing and composing new music. He was the first composer to be granted the rights to set Dr. Seuss's words to music, and his Green Eggs and Ham has been called the most successful piece written for families this half century. There's a CD featuring Nathan Gunn and Isabel Leonard in two of his most popular family music compositions, Chris von Alsberg's Polar Express and Dr. Seuss's Gertrude McFuzz. He's appeared on the NBC Today Show. He's presented a special What Makes It Great for broadcast on PBS's Live from Lincoln Center. And he's written two books, the award-winning All You Have to Do Is Listen and What Makes It Great, the first book of its kind to be especially designed for the iPad with embedded musical examples. And he's currently finishing a new book on the American Songbook. In past episodes, Rob has featured songbooks of great composers. He's also focused on major masterpieces from the chamber music and even solo instrumental realm. But on this program, we will feature symphonic music and music of one of the first great symphonists, a composer whose prolific output in this area laid the groundwork and paved the way for the great 19th and 20th and 21st century symphonists to follow. Tonight we'll focus on the final symphony, the Symphony No. 104 in D major, nicknamed the London, by Franz Joseph Haydn. And Rob will welcome as his special guests and will be conducting the Manhattan School of Music Chamber Symphonia. Chamber Symphonia performs standard and contemporary works composed for chamber orchestra. It was created as the principal training ensemble for students in the graduate program in orchestral performance at this school on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Manhattan School of Music seeks to nourish musicians of the highest artistic caliber and prepare them intensively in their large ensembles to perform the orchestral repertoire for careers as symphonic players. Chaired by former New York Philharmonic Concertmaster Glenn Dichterow, the program's faculty is made up of principal players of major New York orchestras. We'll send you now down to the stage of Merkin Concert Hall at the Kauffman Music Center in Midtown Manhattan for What Makes It Great with Rob Capello and the Manhattan School of Music Chamber Symphonia.
Welcome to our third What Makes It Great program of the season. How many of you have been to all three programs? Fantastic. Do you feel smarter? Don't answer that question. For the radio audience, everyone raised their hands. Do we have any newcomers coming to one of these What Makes It Great programs for the first time? Excellent. Great, great, great. For newcomers, the program's divided up into three parts: discussion, demonstration, where we tear the piece apart for about 60 minutes, intermission, then a complete performance, which hopefully you'll hear with new ears, and then straight without pause into a short question and answer session with the entire orchestra, where you have the rare opportunity of asking anyone on stage, and I hope you'll talk directly to the orchestra. I told them they have to answer whatever you ask. You can ask anything you like about the program, Haydn, music in general, what it's like to be a student at the prestigious Manhattan School of Music, their thoughts on the future, anything you like, and we'll be sure to answer. The Q&A is one of the most fun parts of the evening, so I hope you'll stay with us till the bitter end of the evening. Now, I want to get into tonight's program in a somewhat unusual way. I've always been a huge fan of detective novels, and when I was in my 20s, I briefly considered writing one myself, which is how I happened to be reading Larry Beinhart's witty and entertaining writer's manual called How to Write a Mystery. Though this might seem like an unlikely place to come across a thought-provoking perspective on Haydn, listen to this. Quote, although a book, for our purposes tonight, you can move a piece of music. Although a book appears to be a monologue, writing is a dialogue between author and reader. The body of knowledge, the experience of the genre which the writer shares with the reader, makes it possible for the conversation to take place. In many ways, it defines the language in which the conversation takes place. Or in other words, an audience's knowledge of music and experience with other symphonies determine the kind of symphony that a composer could write and whether or not it would be understood, whether it would be a dialogue or a monologue. Haydn's final symphony, the so-called London Symphony, was his 12th symphony written expressly for his wildly successful and famous visits to London in 1791-92 and 1794-95. By the time this piece was premiered on April 13th, 1795, Haydn had become the most famous composer in the world. And his audience was not only extremely familiar with classical period style in general, but Haydn's symphonies in particular. Because of their vast body of knowledge and experience with this music, Haydn was able to engage in an incredibly sophisticated, witty dialogue with his audience. Now, no pressure on you, but my goal for tonight is to make sure that your ears are the equal to anyone in Haydn's audiences, to make sure that our performance after intermission will be a dialogue and not a monologue, and to make sure that you don't miss a single plot twist in Haydn's incredible detective novel of a symphony. And since I've only got an hour to do it, we better get started. So in Haydn's music, possibility is everywhere. Every musical idea, no matter how seemingly insignificant, contains something of value, something to be worked with. And the opening two measures of this symphony are a perfect example. Here's how the symphony begins. Stravinsky says all creativity begins with observation, with noticing what's right in front of you. So let's see what Haydn noticed in these opening two measures that you or I might possibly have missed. Now, the notes couldn't be simpler. There are only two. Just two notes, and they're the most basic notes in all tonal music. What musicians call tonic and dominant. Home and away, the poles of the tonal axis. All right, I'm going to play you the first four-note idea, and I want you to answer two questions for me. One, how many notes are the same? And two, do we leap up or down to the final note? So two questions. Here we go. So how many notes are the same?
Three.
And do we leap up or down? Anyone get it wrong and feel badly about themselves? Okay, just, we want to make sure everyone's on the same page. Okay, so three notes are the same, and we leap up. So we'll call this repeat leap up. All right, I'm going to play the second four-note idea. Same two questions. How many notes are the same, and do we leap up or down to the last note? Giving it away. How many notes are the same?
Three.
And do we leap up or down?
Down.
All right, it's going to be a good night, I can already tell. All right, now. There are three other things that Haydn notices in this opening that you or I might have missed, and they're going to be the key to the rest of the introduction. So first question, was the opening two measures loud or soft? Both measures?
Yes.
Yes, okay, remember that both measurement. We got a very eager answer over there. Very good, okay. Now, next, I want you to notice that at the end of each measure, there's a timpani roll. Keep that in mind. Then third, and this is subtle, with only two notes, the key is unclear. We could be in a major key, or we could be in a minor key. So four things to remember. The shape is three repeated notes, leap up, three repeated notes, leap down, both measures are loud, timpani roll at the end, and the key's unclear. We're gonna play it one more time to make sure you got it, okay? Okay, now that you've got that, you're really in a position to be absolutely stunned by measure three. 4 seconds into the piece, listen to the astonishing transformation of that opening fanfare in the next measure. I hope your jaws have just dropped. All right, what just happened? Well, first of all, the rhythm is clearly the same. What about the shape? Instead of three repeated notes, leap up, we now have two repeated notes and just a step up. And we are now clearly in a minor key. This was ambiguous. Now we're clearly in a minor key. Our loud fanfare has now become a soft, mysterious question, and we have no timpani roll at the end, but instead, as we're holding that last note, we have a new answering figure in the violins, which we're gonna call and, sir, sing that and, sir. Now, watch Haydn's mind go to work on these few simple ideas. He starts by simply repeating the measure you just heard to get it lodged in your ear, and then see if you can follow it in real time. So here's next moment. Two D's, step up, and answer. We start the same. Change the chord, changes the melody, and an answer. Now we work with and an answer. And an answer. Watch this. Your jaws dropped the first time, they have to drop even further for this one. All right, now, couple questions. One, what happened to our fanfare? Well, first of all, it's been transposed, which simply means repeated starting on another note. Instead of three D's, leap up, now we're higher. Three F's, leap up. Also, we are now clearly in a major key. This is ambiguous. This is not ambiguous. Also, both measures are loud, but do we have a timpani roll? No timpani roll whatsoever. So to review, the shape is the same, it's transposed, now starts higher. Both measures are loud, no timpani roll, and we're now clearly in a major key. I hope you've got that on your checklist. Because comparing versions is at the heart of following out Haydn's particular kind of detective novel. Otherwise, it's like a crime scene investigator looking at two crime scene photos and not noticing the missing kitchen knife in photo two, the missing timpani roll in photo two. All right, now, let's see if you can follow the development of these few ideas in real time. All right, now we just looked at repeat, step up. What do you think an upside down version replacing down with up of repeat, step up would be? It would start with repeat and then what? Step down. You're so smart. That's why you've been here for three programs. All right. We now start to work with repeat step down like this. Step down and an answer. Do it higher. And an answer. Now the and an answer start to come faster. And an answer goes down to the cellos and basses. Just the cellos. dissonance there. And an eh, sir. Fanfare three. That is an amazing moment. If you were really inside Haydn's language, this final fanfare is unbelievable. First, the shape. We start exactly the same as the first one. But the second one changes dramatically by changing only one note. Raise your hand when we hear the change. I'll try not to give it away. Very good. One note. It seems so simple, yet it feels so cosmic. Now, what happens to the dynamic level? Originally, it was two loud measures. Now, what if we got one loud measure and one soft measure? Do we have any timpani rolls? We have a timpani roll in the first measure, but no timpani roll in the second. Remember, comparing crime scene photos is what it's all about, noticing what's the same and what's different. Now, the final measure of the introduction uses and an answer going up and down in the oboe. First going up like this, then going down, and it finishes in a minor key. And then there's a wonderful pause before all the mysteries dispelled, and we start the main body of the movement in a quick tempo in a radiantly major key. So here's the last measure of the introduction, and then the opening of the main body of the movement. The fantastic pause. The ending. That's courtesy of me. Now, by the way, don't they sound fantastic, this orchestra? Yes? Now, if Stravinsky says all creativity begins with observation, with noticing, let's see what Haydn notices here. The whole introduction grew out of what he noticed in the opening fanfare. The whole allegro grows out of what he noticed in that opening tune. So we'll get inside his brain and hear what he hears. Here's just the first four measures. All right, now, even within that simple, singable tune, Haydn's ear hears distinct units. The first unit is the first four notes, a step up and a step down in this rhythm. Step up, step down, sing that. Ready, go. Good, the other idea is the last six notes, four of which are the same, one, two, and then a two-note sigh. So we're going to call this one, two, three, four, sigh. Ready, sing. Oh, but I need a little more sigh on the sigh. Ready, and. So those are the two ideas. In between, there's a little connector. Step up, step down. One, two, three, four, sigh. I'll play the whole thing. You sing the step up, step down. One, two, three, four, sigh. Here we go. Ready, sing. Wait. One, two. That's all you need to write a symphony. You can go home. Okay, good. Now, everything is an idea for Haydn. The next two measures are essentially this, all three parts moving downward in the same direction in the same rhythm. This is basically what it is. This is simple. But listen to the wonderful energy and life that the syncopated second violin gives to the passage. Instead of just, it becomes ya, oom-ba, 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 and it becomes Haydn jazz like this. And listen to that lovely ending, a duet in the violins with an independent viola part put together. Now that's part one of the melody. The second half of the melody starts by repeating the opening four measures. Remember, compare crime scene photos, notice what's the same and what's different. Second half starts exactly like the first, like this. Now this is what Haydn wit is all about. Instead of doing our syncopated scale going down, he says, what if I wittily go in the opposite direction? And then instead of my pointless ending, he has the entire orchestra burst in to begin his transition. So instead of going down, we now go up like this. Transition. Just the last measure. So often in Haydn's symphonies, a short opening idea filled with possibilities like ours is played by only a small section of the orchestra, often just the strings. And then just as it's about to finish, the full orchestra bursts in with a bustling, energetic transition filled with short, catchy ideas. Now, for Haydn, the order of these ideas, which idea leads to which, is as important as the content, which is actually often standard classical period boilerplate. He's going to create enormous surprise later in the movement by completely reordering this music, like a scrambled jigsaw puzzle. So, for example, if the ideas were first presented in neat order, idea 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, later they might come back, starting with idea 3, then go backwards to 2, then insert some new material, then skip back to 1, some more material, and then leaving idea 4 and 5 out completely until they somehow sneak in at the last moment to end the movement itself. For Haydn, the order of the ideas is itself an idea. And these bustling, energetic transitions almost always end with a neat paragraph-ending bump, bump, bump that lets you know where you are, one section has ended, and the new one's about to begin. Here's the end of this little transition section. End part one. Now, one of Haydn's most distinctive traits, which reviewers constantly commented on, is what musicians call his monothematicism. What this simply means is that if most composers made up their expositions out of two fundamentally different ideas, a first theme and a second theme, often contrasting, Haydn tend to make one theme do service for both. Now, as is so often the case with reviewers, they were partially correct. Haydn, it's true, often begins the second part of his expositions with the music of the first theme, but then he nearly always varies it, and it's actually the differences between the versions that are the point. Always remember, compare crime scene photos. The second theme does start with the first theme, again, transposed, you know what that means. Not down here, but up here. But then the ending is completely changed, and that's what's key for Haydn. What's different, not the same. Here's the second theme beginning, starts just like the first one. Step up, step down. 1, 2, 3, 4, stop. The syncopated scale, all the same. Now, start without accompaniment. Imitate. All new. Brand new. The lovely music that closes this section will ultimately return to end the movement, so get this first version in your ear. And again, notice how often these short ideas immediately repeat so that they stick in your memory, like this. Repeat. Another short idea. Repeat. The exposition ends with another one of those clear paragraph-ending pauses, and here's that final moment of clarity, enjoy it, before we embark on the wild development section in the middle. Last moment of clarity. Down to the basis. A scale. Join. And now the heart and soul of Haydn, the place where possibilities become reality, where the plot thickens, the development section. Here's the first phrase. All right, let's see what happens there. Now, you remember our opening tune, get ready to sing. 1, 2, 3, 4, sigh. Sing just the ending part, the 1, 2, 3, 4, sigh. Ready, sing. Raise your hand when you hear the note that's different. I won't help. Okay, that becomes the opening idea. Then we do it an octave higher. subtly change the second chord. Now watch this. This is something that only you would get, only you insiders, okay? We then do it higher, but he turns this into our syncopated scale, like this. Now watch this, the action heats up. Sing one more time our basic 1, 2, 3, 4, si, ready, sing. Which now becomes this. 1, 2, whoa, sing that one. 1, 2, 3, 4, si. That goes down to the low strings, copied in the woodwinds. They overlap like this. And then 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, stop. Okay, an amazing passage. Then the whole orchestra bursts in with 1, 2, 3, 4, si in our bass part, going down a simple scale like this. 1, 2, 3, 4. Do it lower. Keep the scale going. Lower. I mean, we're using this incredibly simple material and making a piece out of it. Listen to that scale going down, all 1, 2, 3, 4, si. 1, 2, 3, in the horns. 1, 2, 3, 4, here. Exciting accompaniment. Now watch this abstraction. I want you to clap the rhythm for me of 1, 2, 3, 4, si. Ready, clap. Now I want you to do 5 of them and a stop at the end and put an and in the middle. Like this. So you're going to do 1, 2, 3, 4, si, and 1, 2, 3, 4, si, and 1, 2, and you can do 5 of them, and the last one, 1, 2, 3, 4, si, and stop. And I want you to do that as I play the melody of the next section. And what you're going to notice is that though the melody sounds absolutely nothing like the opening theme, the only fact that's similar is that every 5-note fragment ends with a si. Though the melodies are completely different, they're all linked for Haydn by the rhythm. So you're going to clap 1, 2, 3, 4, si, 1, 2, 3, 4, si, 5 times as I play the melody and add stop at the end. Ready, go. 2, 3, 4, si, 1, 2, 3, 4, si, 1, 2, 3, 4, si, 1, 2, 3, 4, si, and stop. Perfect. Everything is connected for Haydn. Anything that goes 1, 2, 3, 4, si in that rhythm and has a si at the end is connected. In Haydn's world, no matter how different we look on the surface, we're all connected by our fundamental humanity, by the fact we all go 1, 2, 3, 4, si. Here's what that sounds like in the violins. 1, 2, 3, 4, si. Always a si at the end. 1, 2, 3, 4, si. 1, 2, 3, 4, si. 1, 2, 3, 4, si, and stop. The development's final step starts with your favorite 1, 2, 3, 4, si. Does it here? 1, 2, 3, 4, si, and eventually, just like Beethoven, works with nothing but si. Here's the ending of the development. 1, 2, 3, 4, si. 1, 2, 3, 4. Now, thinking out loud, where should I go? Here. 1, 2, 3, 4, si, si, si. 1, 2, 3, 4, si. 1, 2, 3, 4, si. Now, 1, 2, 3, 4, si. All sides. Getting ready. And you can't stand it. We're ready to come back to the beginning. Fantastic, great. Now, the recapitulation or the final section of the movement begins with a literal return of our opening, but the second half of the tune is exquisitely written and rewritten for woodwind solos with the tune hidden in the oboe. So once again, we start the same and then vary. You know, one of the most profound comments about all composition, which is really about life as well as composition, is Stravinsky says, all composition comes down to a balance between unity and variety. Too much unity, too much repetition leads to boredom, but too much variety leads to chaos. So the first phrase is identical and then completely varied, the perfect mixture of unity and variety, like this. We start the same. Step up, step down. The syncopated scale, all the same. Woodwinds alone. Didn't those woodwinds sound great, yes? Now, as I mentioned, Yeah, bravo. As I mentioned earlier, recapitulation for Haydn is all about reordering, about taking all those short, catchy transition ideas, changing their order, adding new material in between, so you have absolutely no idea what's coming next. Going forwards in the piece, everything is surprising and confusing, but when you look backwards, everything's there. All the important material is there, but in continually surprising locations. So here's the beginning of all that transition music you heard the first time, coming back the second time. Once again, unity and variety, it begins like an exact copy of the first time, like this. Brass, 1, 2, 3, 4, 7. All new. Uh-oh. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. And then an amazing 2 measures of silence. Absolutely nothing for 2 measures as you go, what could possibly come next? And what comes next is brand new material with the first plucked music in the low strings of the entire movement, like this. 1, 2, 3, 4, 1. Tease with step up, step, up, step, tease. Where is it? All new, brand new. And the invention continues to the very last measure of the movement. Here's how the movement finally ends. 1, 2, 3, 4, side and right. I mean, what could be simpler than this? I mean, it's really basically, the big event in its life is, but it's become this enormous source of possibility for Haydn. Here we go. Here's the final measures of the movement. 1, 2, 3, 4. Brand new music. French horns. Bravo. You know, one of the ultimate messages of Haydn's music is that things are not always what they appear to be. And the second movement of the symphony is a perfect example. To be honest, when this starts, it sounds like something from Masterpiece Theater or Downton Abbey. I mean, what I call wig and corset music. I mean, you can almost see these elegant courtiers bowing and scraping. Oh, how delightful, graceful, elegant, refined, old-fashioned music. Doesn't get more perfect than this. Perfect Masterpiece Theater. Ah, yes. And we repeat. Oh. Ooh. Okay, so we start off with this simple tune. Rest, rest. And pay attention and remember, rest, rest. Silence is a source of possibility for Haydn. Those rest, rest will soon be filled in. Then one little surprise accent. This is classic Haydn, Farewell Symphony. Oh! Then a simple 4-note scale up and down. A scale goes up, then down. But instead of, what if I decorate it? And you just eyebrows go, oh, isn't that cute? Then we start to repeat, but instead of the first time, pause, pause, we change the chord and hold it. And then we take that whole opening shape and turn it into this. With these two lovely cello bass notes to end, which couldn't be more perfect. Now, once again, nothing is too trivial for Haydn to hear possibilities in it. Those insignificant cello notes that you just heard, these two, actually become the first violin's first notes of the next phrase 2 octaves higher. This, these two, become the melody, these two, higher, stop, and that accompanies the opening tune, which is now down in the cello. But instead of rest, rest, we now fill it in with something as simple as 1, 2, 3, 4, psi. Now we just fill it in with a simple 3-note scale. Haydn is made out of the tiniest scraps. Here we go. Fill it in with 3-note scale. Then the violas get to do it. And the 3-note scale. That's enough for Haydn to invent a whole symphony. What can you do with 3-note scale? He says, well, I'll do it lower. A 3-note scale. But what if I decorate it? A 3. Now watch this. This is pure Haydn. We've got the simplest idea imaginable. A 3-note scale. We put it in the lower strings. A 3-note scale. A 3-note. What if we go in the opposite direction in the violins? Down instead of up. And what if we decorate it? Then we make a close. All of this made out of a simple 3-note scale that filled in nothing other than rest, rest. Here's that phrase. Cellos. A 3-note scale. Violas take it. A 3-note scale. Do it lower. Decorate it. A 3-note scale. A 3-note scale. And it makes a close. Now, when we finish, we return to the opening, just as if we're doing one of those standard ABA tunes. ABA meaning tune, middle, back to the return. This is the kind of tune that Wigan Corset music is filled with in hundreds of different pieces. And we even have the witty addition of the bassoon who's doubling the melody, giving it that buffoon-like quality that bassoons are so famous for. So here's the return to the opening. We understand this world, ABA, back to the beginning. Oh, isn't it so cute when we add the bassoon on top like this. Rest, rest. Out of nowhere, suddenly, wait. What's this? What? Suddenly, the longest note in the entire movement. Uh-huh, what? Whatever happened to Downton Abbey? And we have this wonderful fermata for non-musicians, which simply means hold the chord for an unspecified length of time, and I will hold it for the longest possible amount of time to make you as uncomfortable as I possibly can. All right, now, that little fermata, as we call it, is our first tiny indication that things might not be what they appear to be, that there might be some surprises in our future. The conclusion of the phrase, however, contains a few lovely little small surprises and this beautiful, peaceful close that says, don't worry, all is well and safe in Haydn's world. So here's the end of it. A little accent. Another surprise accent. Now, smooth and connected, rich harmony. A little decoration. Listen to this beautiful, peaceful close. And cellos. I mean, doesn't this orchestra sound really good tonight?
Yeah.
Now, in Haydn, it's always when you feel safest that you're in the most danger. And the world as you know it is about to disappear. Now, the first hint that you're in trouble comes when the opening four measures get shifted ominously into a minor key played by the woodwinds alone. You always know you're in trouble when the woodwinds play alone. So, that opening that you heard, that you know so well, now gets shifted into a minor key in the woodwinds ominously like this. Then chaos. The world as you know it vanishes, and suddenly music with a kind of violence and passion that seemed to be no part of this movement whatsoever bursts in. Wigs and corsets disappear, and your quaint English mystery with butlers, teas, and crumpets gets replaced by full-bore Stephen King. Suddenly the music explodes. Cadence. dead. Silence. Silence is so powerful in Haydn. After a highly dramatic pause, I told them to keep up their bows as long as possible. I thought they did an excellent job. After a highly dramatic pause where we try to make sense of that world, what just happened, Haydn briefly tries to recapture the old world with a short version of the opening tune. But after three measures, the tumult of the new world bursts in yet again. Here's Can We Ever Go Home Again? Maybe? No. Seconds. Trade-offs in the violin. Higher and minor. Start a third time. Speed up the ending. Accent. Add brass. We eventually return and repeat the opening, and when it starts to not only repeat, but be wittily varied, we think once again, phew, we're safe. I mean, we're familiar with these kind of light Wiggin corset, witty variations, and we now feel secure that we can somehow put behind us that uncontrolled drama and passion in the middle part of the movement as a distant memory. You know, we did that kind of drama in college, but now we're older and more mature. Things are now back under control, or so we think. All familiar music. Rest, rest. We know this music, we're safe again. An exact copy. And witty light variations. Change, a little burst. Oh, what a card that Haydn. But then out of nowhere, little more changes. Pause, but still we're fundamentally safe. When we go through part two of the tune and return to the opening, just like we did the first time, again, ABA, tune, middle, return, we're ready for a repeat and an ending, and the little decoration that it starts with only makes the ending seem a little more delightful, or so we think. Now, this gets a lovely little decoration here. Decorate. Copy it. Oh, yes. But then, out of nowhere, everything changes. What? Where are we? No melody? What key? What? No explanation. Gets louder. That fermata is devastating. We no longer have any idea what kind of a movement this is, what key we're in, or what could possibly come next, and now it gets even worse. The strings drop out, and the woodwinds take the opening of the movement to a key so remote that it seems like we could never possibly find our way back home. And it slows down. And another irritating pause. We do it lower, which explains absolutely nothing. Where are we? It seems like even Google Maps could not possibly find our way back home. The strings join in a desperate attempt to somehow find our way back home. Maybe here. Maybe here. Maybe here. Timpani comes in to help. And we are back. Because our world has been so profoundly disturbed, we require balance and conciliation to end. So Haydn takes that peaceful close, which originally ended the tune, and exquisitely lengthens it to become this beautiful close with a brand new little chromatic line in the second violins, making it even more expressive. Here's the final version of that peaceful close. New line. Flower. Pastoral horns. All violence gone, passion gone, and we're safe again. An extraordinary movement. Now, if you listen to any classical period symphony, you're likely to hear a minuet and trio. The minuet and trio is as close as a classical period comes to a fixed form. Like a sonnet or a haiku, the externals of the form are fixed, and audiences knew what to expect. They expected to hear a movement in quick three beats to a measure. A one, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three, in three overall sections. The first section, called the minuet, would be in two parts, both parts repeated. The middle section, called the trio, also in two parts, both parts repeated. Then you go back and play the minuet through without repeats. So minuet, trio, minuet, A, B, A for short. Within this incredibly fixed form, extraordinary variety was possible. Again, unity variety. And no one found more possibilities than Haydn. We're going to start by just playing the opening of this minuet and then show you all the fantastic details that make this minuet great. Here's the opening of the minuet. Help you appreciate the tiny details that make this minuet so great, we're going to play a version of the opening four measures, but we're going to leave out the third beat of each measure, and see if this helps you notice something about the first two beats of every measure. I certainly think after three programs this season, you might get it. Okay, so this is the opening four measures, but we've just removed the third beat of every measure. One, two, three. Got it? Every measure is the same, and the first two beats of every single measure are the same two repeated notes. Everything starts with repeat, 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 repeat. Now listen closely as we add in the third beats, and what you'll hear are three different ways to lead into repeat. Again, unity variety. Every measure, two beats are the same. Repeat, repeat. Now, three different ways to lead into repeat. That together. We're going to call the first unit and repeat, then we approach it from higher, then we approach it from lower, then we decorate it. Decorate it. So you're going to learn and repeat from higher, from lower, decorate it. And I've now ruined it for everyone in the room forever. Let's sing that. One, two, and repeat from higher. Decorate, and a different body motion for the from higher, from low. Decorate, something will help one more time. One, two, and repeat from high, from low. Decorate. So the first two beats are always the same, but it's the way that you lead into it that makes it great. Now, the phrase continues with two more measures that start with repeat, but now it's different repeated notes. Instead of, the repeated notes now are, and we lead into it like this, and repeat, and repeat, and now what makes Haydn great. Anyone else would have finished with another bar of repeat, and repeat, and we're done. That would be normal, and repeat, and we're done. But he has only one measure that doesn't have repeat, and what it has instead is a fantastic trill. So instead of, and repeat, and we're done, we get, and trill, and we're done. And that trill is also in the brass, which makes it even more fantastic. The one measure that isn't and repeat. So listen for and repeat, and trill, and we're done. Here we go. And repeat, and trill. And repeat the whole thing softer. From lower, decorate it, and repeat, and trill, and we're done. Now the action heats up in the minuet's second phrase. Our opening six beats, and repeat from higher, now become this, and repeat, go up now, go higher and stop. And if you're really inside it and expecting this, when you go like this, it seems like the hugest climax in the universe. Everything is within a context. Here's what he does instead. Go higher, go higher, and stop. Now you are going to be one of the few audiences in the world, probably not even Haydn's audience, got, which you're going to now get. So do this with me. I want you to sing and repeat from higher. Ready and sing. And repeat from higher. All right, now just sing the first four notes like this. And repeat, ready, sing. Now let's put it in a minor key like this. And repeat, ready, sing. Now get rid of that note and make it only the first three and do it three times like this. We're gonna make and repeat into this. And re, and re, and re, ready, go. And we have now changed the fundamental three-beat pulse of the piece, one, two, three, one, two, three, into one, two, one, two, one, two. Now that you've got and re, and re, and re, your expert, let's transpose it and do it here. And re, and re, and re, ready, sing. So while the lower strings are going and re, and re, on top we put repeat, 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 and now the fantastic part. While they're going and re, and re, and they try to play a scale, but they're so confused they can't find their downbeat because these people are playing in two. So they're trying to play a scale, but then finally, phew, we fixed it. Now this all goes on in microseconds of time, but now you're inside it. So here's that whole second phrase. See if you can really be inside Haydn. So what are you listening for? And repeat, go higher, and stop, then change to repeat, and re, and re, and re, re. See if you can hear it, here we go. And repeat, go up now, go higher, and stop. That's pretty incredible, right? Okay. How many people didn't get it whatsoever but are smiling anyway? Now, to prepare for the return to the opening, Haydn beautifully combines essences. The flute and oboe four times do from higher, from higher, from higher, from higher, while the violins take our opening and repeat and turn it into and repeat and re. Putting together, you get this. Then we are back to the beginning where we first started. Here's what it sounds like. From high. Timpani, we are back to the beginning. Watch this. That pause is what makes Haydn great. Now follow this. To make an ending, what he's basically doing, and you're going to get this, he's extending the close of the section by doing what I call and trill stop three times. And trill stop, and trill stop, and a third time. If it were a normal composer, here's what the passage would sound like. Three and trill stops. This would be normal. And trill stop, and trill stop, and trill stop. But here's what happens instead. He does the first one, and trill stop. Does the second one, and trill stop. But instead of and trill stop, he goes and inserts two unbelievable bars of nothing. He stops after and. Everyone in the world is expecting, and instead we just get and. And then finally, when we get to do trill stop, he doubles the length of it. Instead of trill stop, we go trill stop. This is what Haydn is all about. Here's that whole phrase. And trill stop, and trill stop, and trill stop. Isn't that fantastic? Yeah. Now, good news or bad news, I'm going to leave you completely on your own for the trio. Hopefully, you'll be able to follow it yourself, and we're going to skip ahead to the finale. Though today, we tend to make major distinctions between serious and popular music, as you could see if you watched the Grammys, where classical music wasn't present in any way whatsoever. One of Haydn's great achievements was to create a style in which the two were effortlessly fused without making any artistic concessions whatsoever. The main theme of this finale not only sounds like a folk tune, it actually is a Croatian folk tune. Here's how the tune begins. Does that sound anything like this Croatian folk tune called O Jelena? It's the exact same tune. Now, though it might not be immediately apparent to anyone but Haydn, there are actually two distinct parts in that opening. First and most obviously is the tune itself, which, as in so much folk music, is based on repetition to make it catchy and stick in the ear. It starts with a little three-note ideal that I'll call sigh, leap, do it lower, sigh, leap, a little rustic continuation. And we end the first half with a step up. Second half is an exact repeat. The only thing that changes is the last note. Sigh, leap, sigh. So the first half ends with a step up. The second half ends with repeat. So get the tune in your ear. Sigh, leap, sigh, leap. First half ends with a step up. Sigh, leap, sigh, leap. This half ends with repeat. Here's what it sounds like in violins. Sigh, leap, sigh. First half ends with a step up. Sigh, leap. Now, underneath this tune is simply a held note in the cellos and the horns, kind of like a bagpipe's drone. Nobody but Haydn would ever have paid attention to this as a musical idea. This is not great. I wanted you to hear the entire length of that, 10 measures of that. Who but Haydn would ever hear possibility in watch and see. Now, the lack of accompaniment, nothing but a drone bass, only makes this tune sound more and more rustic. Now, for future reference, if this is a beat, I want you to tell me how many beats does the drone hold before the melody begins. I'll click off the beat, you tell me how many beats of drone before the melody comes in the first violin. So here we go. How many beats before they came in? Well, she's counting an interesting kind of beats with six. Let's do that one more time. Let's do it one. Hopefully there should be four. Here we go. One more time. Got it? Four beats before they come in. Just keep that in mind. You wouldn't believe that that could be a topic for a finale. Now, one of the great things about the emptiness of this opening version is that it gives Haydn the opportunity to fill it in, which he does almost immediately when the tune repeats. Listen to this next version and how full, rich, and sophisticated it sounds when this rustic folk tune is brought into the world of classical period technique. Out of the fields with the peasants and into the concert hall like this. Never, not like this. Listen to how full it sounds in this next version. All right, let's make sure you hear all the elements since they're the key to the rest of the entire movement. Against the original tune over here, we have what we call a counter melody, just means a melody against it, in the second violins, which is also based on repetition. Listen to how clear these ideas are in the second violin. This is the counter melody. So again, a little simple two-note idea done twice. Once, then high, then five catchy notes that you can't miss. Five notes down, then back up. Five notes down, then back up. This, five notes down, unbelievable. This and this are gonna be main topics in the movements. Just sing five notes down, ready, go. One more time, ready, go. And you know that what's gonna happen later is five notes up, sing it. Five notes up. So we've got in our ear, five notes down, then back up. Repeat exactly. Five notes down, then ending. Now, see if you can really hear the two parts together. We'll do this more than once if you want, but I really want you to hear both parts. Melody over here, counter melody here. See if you can really hear just those two parts. Could you hear both parts? Yes? Okay. Do you need it again? You're all right. One more time. One more time. Let's do it one more time. This is the one that's harder to hear. Here we go. Once, then twice, then five notes down, then back up. Got it? Okay, good. Now, the folk tune originally continued like this. Here's how the full orchestra bursts in Haydn's piece straight out of the folk tune. But now, new. Change. Return. fantastic music. Now, the return of the opening is a perfect example of just how sophisticated and powerful Haydn's treatment of the popular could be. Let's look closely now. Reminder for yourself. How many beats did that drone last before the melody came in? Four beats, and was it loud or soft? Soft the first time. Reminder, here was the original drone. One more time, four beats and soft. One, two, three, two. That's what happened the first time. Now that soft cello horn drone becomes a blazing full orchestra fortissimo drone with the entire orchestra and the timpani rolling. This little, now becomes this. And there's more. The original drone had the melody start here. Get in your ear. Now it goes here. Passes it to the second violins. While they have a shooting scale above, that's just the first 4 seconds of the loud version. And then we go wild on psi, leap, psi, leap. Here's the loud version, the second version. Talked about how Haydn loves to use the music of his first theme for his second theme, varied, and here's a perfect example of how powerful this can be. For his second theme, now watch this, you can actually get this, probably even better than his audience. The original drone was on a D. You don't have to know names of notes, think of it as a label. Now, he just says, unity, variety. What if I do the drone on a different note, on an A, but now, not a single note, a full chord. So the drone is now a full chord. Now, how many beats was it before the melody came in? Four. So what should happen is this. One, two, three, four. How many beats happen now? Now it's only two beats. So the drone has been transposed. It's two beats instead of four beats. And in comes the melody, and there's still more. Now, you remember that little counter melody that you listened to over here? Originally, it was below the melody. Now we flip it upside down. Now we put them on top. So here's the beginning of the second theme. It's the first theme with a single note drone, with a full chord, coming in after two beats, not four beat, and now the parts are flipped upside down. The second theme is the first theme varied, but it's the differences between the two versions that count, not what's the same. Here it is, second theme. Two beats. Once again, nothing is too ordinary for Haydn. Watch what he hears in that one little fast scale that I had you sing. You remember that fast scale out of five notes down, then back up. Sing one more time, our five notes down, ready, go. Now sing the opposite way, five notes up, go. He makes those two ideas, five notes down and five notes up, the topic of the entire next section of music. First, he just alternates versions and turns it into a melody like this. Five notes down, five notes up, five notes down, five notes up, like this. Five notes down, five notes up, five notes down. Five. Then we do the up version four times in cello and bassoon, like this. Five notes up, five notes up. Then we do the same versions simultaneously in opposite directions, creating this wildly energetic whirlwind. Some going down, some going up, looking at each other in a mirror like this. The music pauses for a moment to catch its breath with a long melody in slow notes that will have an important history later, like this. Imitated in bassoon and viola. This sophisticated exposition ends as it began with rustic, popular music, everybody playing in unison, what could literally be a popular dance, but try to stay in your seats. Now, the first time the little thing that the flute played gets copied by the strings, and we're back to the opening. The whole exposition repeats a second time. The second time we get to that same moment, that little flute phrase goes down to the violas, And he discovers it can combine with the opening of the main theme, with our... See if you can hear them together. Flip the parts. Then, Psy Leap goes down to the basses. With... turned into... The two combine like this. And that's just the first 6 seconds. I'm going to leave you on your own for the rest of it. Here's the beginning of that development section, all based on material you know. They get it. To hear. Side, leap, side. Trade-offs. Five notes up, five notes up, five notes up. Opposite. That long melody and slow notes extends to ultimately bring back the opening in an astonishingly subtle surprise and transformation of that opening four beats of seemingly insignificant drone that you mocked when we played it by itself, now in an absolutely astonishing transformation. This is a moment that I guarantee no audience in history but you will ever get. So here's that long, no pressure. Here's that long melody in slow notes and leading to this amazing passage. Extended, violins sneak in, cellos, basses. Where are we going? We're lost. Everything slows down. Mystery. We try to find a home. How will we get there? Watch the horns. That's the opening drone. No one in the world but you notices. Let me explain what's going on here. We get to the end of the development. Here's what should happen. Instead, we get a surprise chord. But the double surprise is not only is a chord surprise, if you listen to the bottom note, it's actually the horns and the cellos playing the opening drone. It's now part of a surprising chord. One, two, three, four. No one knows we're back at the beginning until they hear the tune, except you. But it's right here. It's the opening drone hidden inside that surprising chord. Let's hear this moment. I can see the astonishment in your eyes. Okay, here we go. Drone, one, two, three, we're back. And recapitulations are always filled with fantastic surprises for Haydn. And right in the middle of this thrilling recapitulation, we get this climactic version of the opening tune for the low strings and the horns like this. This is the glorious moment for French horns in this piece. And a finish with the timpani. And the coda that ends the movement is filled with these fantastic touches. It starts by taking our famous sigh, leap, sigh, leap, little decoration, and sigh, leap, and sigh, leap, and keeps it going down, and sigh, leap, and sigh, goes down to the second violins, and sigh, leap, and sigh, leap, and makes a close. And then a spectacular version in the woodwinds with a completely brand new, incredibly witty ending with a fantastic high note that should be the high point of your lives. Here we go. So here, and sigh, leap, and sigh, leap. And sigh, leap, and sigh, leap. Second violin. Second oboe. First. Flute. Now, brand new. I mean, that is such a fantastic note. Now, one final full orchestra version of the main theme with that drone now fortissimo with all the instruments in the orchestra leads to the movement's end with a little five notes up, and new developments till the final measure of the symphony. Here's what our little harmless has finally turned into. One final quick thought, and then we'll take our intermission. Though today, Haydn has become almost a connoisseur's composer, clearly unable to compete at the box office with Beethoven and Mozart. When this piece was first premiered in 1795, Haydn was as famous as any composer in history has ever been. His music was not only popular with the general public, it was equally respected by the musical community. You know, in an interesting, fundamental way, Haydn's music is deeply democratic. So often his musical topics aren't elegantly crafted, exquisite aristocratic melodies like Mozart's, but rather insignificant bits of daily workaday musical life, a short fanfare, a simple scale, or a trill. Yet somehow these ordinary ideas develop extraordinary life and vitality in Haydn's hands as he somehow builds a dazzlingly sophisticated, witty universe out of insignificant building blocks. Nothing and no one in life, Haydn's music teaches us, is insignificant if we only listen closely enough. In a quotation that I'm sure Haydn would have loved from Mark Twain, Twain said, quote, "There never was yet an uninteresting life. Inside the dullest exterior, there is a drama, a comedy, and a tragedy. Possibilities are everywhere. All you have to do is listen." Thank you and enjoy the performance.
We are set now for a complete performance of the Symphony No. 104 in D major, the London Symphony by Franz Joseph Haydn, performed by the Manhattan School of Music Chamber Sinfonia. They will be conducted by Rob Capello. I'm David Ozenberg, and we'll be back in a moment with that complete performance, followed by the Q&A here on What Makes It Great, an exclusive production of the award-winning Classical Network and WWFM.org.